KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I mean, people have been restoring films, obviously, for years, but I couldn't think of a time or an example where someone had taken 100-year-old footage and put all the computer firepower that we have today to the single purpose of trying to make this footage look brand new.
Peter Jackson created new worlds for his Lord of the Rings and Hobbit trilogies. His latest project, They Shall Not Grow Old, is a documentary that magically brings to life 100-year-old footage shot on the front lines of World War I. It was no easy feat, but forget jerky black and white images. Jackson and his team added sound and color to footage that now seems as if it was shot just yesterday with modern cameras. Jackson tells us about hiring forensic lip readers to interpret conversations captured on silent film so actors could perform the lines, and how the techniques used in They Shall Not Grow Old could be used on other old films, including some of his own. But first on the news banter, so much TV. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So FX does its annual report on the state of television, and unsurprisingly, but very strikingly, there are more originals than ever, scripted originals I'm talking about, where peak TV continues to surge. There aren't that many more scripted originals overall in the world. There are 495 in 2018, just up 8 from the record of 487 last year. But the mix is what's striking.
Right. The mix here is interesting because if you think that there is too much to watch on Netflix and you can't possibly watch everything you want to watch, you are not alone, because the numbers show that the number of scripted originals on streaming services, that's Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, CBS All Access, went from 117 last year to 160 this year. That's an extraordinary jump, and it really shows the arms race that we're right now in the middle of between these streaming services trying to compete with traditional cable and broadcast networks. And where we're seeing the hit is on basic cable, because basic cable shows are declining from 175 last year to 144 scripted originals this year. And that's evidence of the shifting economics here. As cable networks are struggling because people are watching things more on demand and through these subscription services, they're ordering fewer shows and they're trying to do cheaper programming. So these numbers are a nice window into the state of the content economy in 2018, and the streamers are ruling.
Yeah, even the broadcast originals are down a little bit. So this is a trend that is likely to continue. I mean, you didn't even mention Apple, and they're going to get into the game. And we're going to see these guys, you know, really fight for that streaming real estate. You know, a lot of people, young people, you know, the concept of watching network television or even cable television isn't so much a thing. So the model is absolutely shifting. Now, let me just turn a little bit to the awards race. The SAG Awards are out. People like to complain about the SAG Awards. You know, Roma is not a movie that's going to attract a lot of attention from SAG, and it did not get an ensemble award. It's not surprising. This is Cuarón's movie based on his childhood in Mexico, a black and white movie that is, you know, an ensemble of some of whom are not professional actors. So professional actors, shockingly, did not nominate a movie with some non-professional actors in it.
Yeah, I actually thought Roma would get a couple SAG noms, because if you look at the SAG Awards, they have a history of nominating performances that are not in English. Adriana Barraza and Rinko Kikuchi, they both got nominations for Babel a few years ago, and they have nominated a lot of non-American actors, even though it is an American guild that gives these awards. So I was a little surprised that the main actors in Roma didn't get a nomination. But like you said, the Professional Actors Guild probably wants to reward more professional actors.
Yeah, I mean, so Roma and Green Book with Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali were not nominated. I will note, as many people do, that only twice in 23 years have films that did not get that ensemble nomination go on to win Best Picture at the Oscars. That was Braveheart in 95 and Shape of Water in 2017. So it is nice to get the recognition from the SAG Awards, but it is not necessarily, we just saw last year, definitive. I mean, I was very surprised to see Bohemian Rhapsody among the nominees. I mean, I thought this was kind of an oddball year to me, you know? I wasn't surprised to see some of these, but The Favorite, all of these actresses who are in The Favorite got nominated, and yet The Favorite did not get an ensemble award.
Yeah, it seems like they went for more popular. I hate to use that phrase because it's so tainted because of the Academy's failed popular Oscar effort, but there were more popular ensembles in Black Klansman and Black Panther and Bohemian Rhapsody and Star is Born. These are all hit movies, and they got SAG ensemble nominations. And don't forget Crazy Rich Asians, which was, I think, surprised a lot of people getting that nomination for ensemble.
Yes, I think there were definitely some surprises, and we won't even get started on the TV stuff because those were surprising too. And I'm just going to share, you know, we've talked a lot about Les Moonves, but we'll just share a little audio. Sybil Shepherd did an interview. You know, this is the story that will not ultimately doesn't seem to want to go away forever. And this is a story that goes back several years to when she had her Sybil sitcom on CBS. She just did an interview on Sirius Satellite Radio. So the setup for this is that Les Moonves, she says, invited her to dinner and expressed some interest in her. He told her that he was dissatisfied with his marriage and apparently also his lady friends. And we'll let the host of this Sirius radio show take it from there.
After this dinner date, though, I want to ask you this. Obviously, you made it clear you weren't interested. He's married, mm-hmm. et cetera. How soon after that, then, did you find that you were having issues with the series?
Quite shortly afterwards.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. Do you think back to that day and wonder if things had gone differently, what would have happened to the show?
It would have run another 5 years.
So I will just note that when that last episode aired, it was a cliffhanger and it said to be continued, but it was not to be continued. And we don't have a comment from Les Moonves. He said that, you know, he's denied wrongdoing in all of these cases where allegations have been made against him. I would say it's not a great appearance. What do you think, Matt?
No, of course not. And, you know, I feel like we're going to see these stories come out more and more.
Drip,
I
mean,
think about all the shows and all of the actresses that interacted with Les Moonves over the years. I mean, we're talking thousands and big stars.
And little stars, yeah.
Yeah, and little. I mean, this is just the beginning of what I think will be a wave of these claims.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
I was 16 years old, and my father allowed me to go.
I was just turned 17 at the time.
I was 16.
And I was 15 years.
When they came to us, they were frightened children and had to be made into soldiers.
Those are just some of the voices featured in the new World War I documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. This being a film from Peter Jackson, the wizard who won 3 Oscars, including Best Picture for his final Lord of the Rings movie, They Shall Not Grow Old is a technological marvel. Jackson has taken original archival footage of the daily life of British troops from 1914 through 1918 and restored it to a point where it feels absolutely modern. He also colorized the film, bringing the soldiers to life. The film's narration comes mostly from interviews with World War I veterans recorded by the BBC about 40 years after the war ended. Jackson has built up quite a film empire in his native New Zealand, but we recently sat down with him in Beverly Hills. How did this get started? I'm not clear. I know that it's a thing, but I don't know where you came into it.
Well, I didn't know I was going to do it, but I was in the UK. I'm pretty sure it was for the premiere of the last Hobbit film, because it was about 5 years ago, so it would make sense. And the Imperial War Museum asked me to come in for a meeting to talk to them. And what they were doing then, this was 2013, I think,
They were preparing their schedule for the 100th anniversary of the First World War from 2014 to 2018. And they were commissioning a lot of different arts projects with, you know, seemed to be dozens and dozens of them, all sorts of different things, as part of their whole four-year program. And they wanted to talk to me about a documentary that they were going to do for the end of the First World War. So this was 2018. So it was 5 years into the future. It seemed like a long, long way into the future. And they just said to me, would I be interested in being involved in it? And, you know, cause, and I said, yeah. I said, what do you have in mind? They said, we don't have anything in mind, just a documentary. But, however, the only proviso is that we want it to just be made from our original First World War archive footage. No new filming, no recreations, no reenactment. It has to be 100% original First World War footage, of which they have an extensive archive, one of the biggest in the world, of that particular war. And I said, okay. And they said, we really want to find somebody who can make a documentary for 2018 who can use our original footage in a fresh and original way. I think fresh and original, okay, right. I haven't got a clue. And all I was doing in my mind was playing every bloody documentary that I've ever seen in my life, decades and decades worth of First World War documentaries, because I do watch them and the same footage.
Did you sort of say, I'm not actually British?
Well, no, because it's the British Empire was involved in this war, and we still consider ourselves
British
part of
enough
the empire,
for these purposes.
British enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it was very much, you know, obviously centered on the British story, because that was all. I was only allowed access to their archive, not to anyone else's. And so I said, well, give me a chance to have a think about it, and you know, I really didn't have a clue what it could be. And so I went back to New Zealand, and then I started to just think about, well, film footage in a fresh and original way, I wonder how well we can restore it. Because,
right.
I mean, people have been restoring films, obviously, for years, but I couldn't think of a time or an example where someone had taken sort of, you know, 100-year-old footage and put all the computer firepower that we have today to the single purpose of trying to make this footage look brand new, like it was shot now. So I was curious, and I didn't know what the result would be, because I obviously have never done it, but I was a question. I thought, well, I wonder how good we can make it look. So then I asked them to send me 2 or 3 minutes. So they scanned something and they sent us a file over the net. And I said, just give me a few weeks and I'll just have a play with it. I just want to try some stuff out. And so I got our team in New Zealand at Park Road Post to then put their heads into how we could restore this stuff.
Let me just say, Park Road Post is obviously this beautiful facility you have in Wellington, which I've luckily visited, you do this amazing work.
Yeah, we've got a reasonably... we've got a little CGI department that's...
A little
because,
one.
Because, well, it's not Weta Digital. Weta Digital,
right,
which is just down the road,
has
got thousands of people.
Thing, yeah.
Park Road Post has got like 30 or 40 people in it who do CGI work now.
The other places where the avatar is and that sort of thing.
Yes, yeah. And so what we came to realise is that you look at this, you've got to just look at it. It's not actually kind of hard in the sense of you just got to watch it and start to list all the problems with it. And they're the problems that we all know from this old footage. I mean, it's the scratches. It's, you know, often what the Imperial War Museum have got is they've got a duplicate of a duplicate of a duplicate. I mean, it's not true entirely. They do have some quite good first generation stuff, but a lot of it's third
but
or
people
fourth.
Are also hand cranking the film.
Yeah, with the speed. So the speed, yep. Mm-hmm. And I've grown up my entire life being led to believe from all the books I read that silent movies, you know, with a hand cranked were 16 frames a second. And I just rediscovered very quickly that it ain't true at all.
Mm-mm.
Because in order to put the speed
right... How could you be
that
consistent as a human?
No, and how can you be consistent if you're under shell fire?
Right,
I'm sure your heartbeat and the adrenaline is going to dictate a little bit of how you're turning the handle of the camera. So, you know, but of course, if you just think about it for a moment, to actually end up at 24 frames a second, which is, you know, we need to get it to today's speed, you can't do that unless you know what the original speed was, because you have to, basically, the computer is like, you tell the computer, this was shot at 13 frames, we want it at 24 frames. Please. If you say please,
the computer likes
being polite.
Right.
You keep doing it till you just nail it. And you know when you nail it, God, if one frame a second, too fast, too slow, you notice it. When it clicks into exactly the speed, everything comes to life and everything feels real and natural. And it's quite. But, of course, what happens too is that I didn't want to make it a step printing kind of thing. So let's just say if it's shot at 12 frames a second, it's the easiest thing to think of. Then one way to do it is be to print every frame twice to get to 24. But that gives you a kind of a jerkiness because you're looking at two frames, then two frames, then two frames, and it doesn't really – I wanted it all to be smooth. And so with the Fortunately, the software that we have now, the computer will create the missing frame. So say you've got like 14 frames a second originally shot, you want to go to 24, you've got 10 frames that don't actually exist. And the computer figures out a way to create those 10 frames, puts them in, and yet the whole thing kind of feels smooth. You don't feel where those extra frames are. And it takes the frames before and after, it blends them together. It creates sort of a new picture from, you know, the original material. It's unbelievable.
Your eye reads it as this very smooth experience.
I mean, I don't even know how it does it.
If you don't know, I guarantee you I don't.
No, fortunately, I just get to say, you know, just to ask them to happen and it happens. But anyway, you realize that a lot of what you're doing when you talk about restoring this stuff is really, you're actually just correcting the damage of 100 years is sort of what you're doing.
I always thought it looked like that then, though. It did, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, I mean, if one of those cameramen shooting and you got it developed and looked at it the next day, it would look sharp and beautiful and clean. Obviously, the speed would be whatever the speed was, but it's subsequently, it's, you know, this film shrinks, the sprocket holes warp and distort, so it, you know, it jiggles around in the printers or the projector. It's just, a lot of it is correcting the damage of 100 years is what you really, to go back to something approaching what the original negative would have been like. And then in the Imperial War Museum, I don't want to claim credit for finding it because it's been sitting in the catalogue for decades, but they've got 42 reels, and a reel meaning 6 to 8 minutes, 42 reels of outtakes. They said, we don't know what this stuff is. No one's ever really gone through it. It's all a mixture of all over the place. And I thought, yep, outtakes is fantastic. That's exactly, I want the outtakes. And so we got these 42 reels, which is hours and hours and hours of footage. And it was incredible stuff in there. This stuff had never been seen before.
You just wanted the kind of day-to-day of life.
And yeah, and a lot of it is the camera original. Because it's outtakes.
Oh, right.
It's
the
original camera.
All the torture,
camera,
yeah.
I mean, it's beautiful, beautiful, pristine quality. That stuff that hasn't been damaged. And nor has it really ever been seen before. So we got a lot of great material from these outtakes.
Was it an expensive process? And did the War Museum say, yes, we can do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the film wasn't very expensive. It's the cheapest movie I've made for a long time since Heavenly Creatures. But no. I mean, I was just lucky because I had all the resources of the museum, so we could phone up and say, can you send us another 25 hours, please? And I just said to them, look, I can't even figure out what this film's about, because they said, have you got any, you know, once we did the test to restore it and we could see how amazing it could look, they were really wanting me to tell them what film I was making. I said, well, I can't, because I've got to see the material. I didn't shoot any of the stuff. I don't know what was there. And I didn't want to have a preconceived notion where I'm got some vision in my head and I sort of try to, you know, make everything fit. I said, I've got to see as much as you can possibly give me. So they sent over 100 hours. I said, look, the deal that I'll do is we'll restore it for free. Every bit of film that you send, we will restore it as a black and white. And so at least your archive will end up with having this, you know, restored. So they were sending me lots and lots of film, which was fantastic. The more I could see, the better. And then we were looking at it, restoring it. This was, now I was talking 2 years is going by. You know, this is like a five-year project, so it went to year two or year three. And one of the things with the restoration is the humanity of the men jumps off the screen. You know, they're suddenly real people again. So then I thought, well, okay, if that's the case, I mean, I was just, this was me making it up as I went along.
And the wheels
were turning. I thought, if that's the case, then with the only voices we should hear are their voices.
Right.
So I then went to the Imperial War Museum and the BBC, and I said, can you send me all the audio interviews that you did with veterans of the war? But I only want them, the ones that you did in the 1960s and 70s, because they did a lot of audio interviews in the 80s and 90s when these guys were like you know, you're almost 100 years old. And I didn't want the voices of 100
years. Right, you wanted it to sound more
vital. I wanted some people a little bit more vibrant and more sort of, you know, sparky.
So that you could imagine they were speaking.
Yeah.
As younger men.
Well, they weren't much older than me, so very young men, yes. than I am now. They were in their 60s and 70s. So the BBC had done a series called The Great War in 1963, and they had interviewed hundreds and hundreds of veterans, of which only a tiny little fraction of it's in the show that they made. So I said, can you give me all those tapes? And they actually didn't quite know where they all were. But over the course of a year or two, they found more and more of them, and I don't know what, in cupboards and shelves, and they kept sending me, you know, more and more which was great, because they're now very pleased because they've gone through and made sense of all these hundreds of rolls of tape that they had been sitting there and unused.
Coming up after a short break, fans of Jackson's early low-budget films, Bad Taste and Meet the Feebles, have a treat in store. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing.
Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Sir Peter Jackson. His newest film is the World War I documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. The film already aired on the BBC in the UK. It will start to play in US theaters on December 17th with an unusual release pattern, so check your local listings. Made up of restored footage, They Shall Not Grow Old is a vivid look at the experience of British soldiers during the Great War, from the patriotism that inspired many to enlist to the grim realities of trench warfare.
We were in conditions that isolated us completely from civilization. We got so degenerate, so isolated, living in this mud.
And you could sympathise with how a rabbit must feel because we were hunted by mankind just the same as a rabbit.
You knew your lives were in one another's hands and it united you very closely and you didn't let anything interfere with that.
In addition to very precise restoration work, Jackson also carefully added colour to much of the black and white footage. Was colorization in your mind early?
Colorization was literally coming together as I went along. There wasn't anything in my mind at the beginning. It was just a slight panic was the only thing in my mind. But once we restored it to a pristine black and white level, it became clear that, you know, okay, these guys are coming to life. We've got all this amazing audio interview material when these guys are reasonably young, and so we've got to colorize it. And, you know, colorizing is a very controversial thing in the film industry, but it's controversial in the sense of, you know, you're taking up a movie the director has chosen to shoot in black and white, a DP has carefully lit it for black and white, and then somebody comes along and smudges color all over it, and, you know, that's obviously not a good thing. But these cameramen were government employees. They were sent by the British government to the Western Front to record the war for posterity. I mean, it's the first time in history that movie film existed in the British government. Fortunately, they had the idea of we should be filming this because one day it will be historical, you know. And they were also using it for propaganda purposes at times too. So, and, you know, and I just thought, well, I don't have an issue with colorization because I'm sure if any one of those government cameramen was packing their bags for the Western Front and somebody walks in and says, now you can take either the black and white film stock or you can take the color film stock, which would you like? They would have grabbed the color straight away, but they couldn't because
it
didn't exist. So I just thought, well, let's make it look like it did for the guys that were there. But then the soundtrack had to be done because people don't realize that even a modern film like, you know, a Tolkien film is you're largely dealing with a silent movie. You know, the actor's dialogue you've got, but if you're doing a dragon on screen and gold coins falling over the place, you don't have any sound for that. You just have to make, you know,
make credit. Noises,
so we've got a
yes.
great sound team that are so fussy and they look at every tiny thing and they make sure it's... So I just gave it to them and said, please just make this sound like there was a recordist right there on the day next to the cameraman. I just want it to sound real. And, of course, that stretches into the people talking on screen because their lips are moving and we don't know what they're saying. I've got a clue. But fortunately, there's people, I had no idea that these people exist, but they're wonderful, clever people. There's forensic lip readers. And I believe they do work mainly for law enforcement, like security camera footage if there's a bank raid or something and they see these guys talking, they want to figure out what they're saying in case there's some clues to solve the crime. So we sent all the shots that we had of people talking to these forensic lip readers. I'm sure they'd never experienced anything quite like this in their lives. Obviously, we'd restored it at this point, so we had the speed of the, you know, it was 24 frames and sharp, and that was very helpful to them. And they would come back and say, well, this is what this guy's saying. And you look at it and think, oh, are they really saying that? I mean, okay. Good. And then we would look at the regiment because the British Army came from all over the UK and their accents go all over the bloody place. And their accent dictates quite a lot of how speed that they talk and the rhythm and the vowels and the consonants and all this. So if the regiment was from Yorkshire, we'd go and get an actor from Yorkshire. If it was from Kent, we'd go and get someone from Kent. And we'd say, look, this is what they're saying. Can you record this? And we put the two together and every time it fitted.
Boys, here it comes. We're in the pictures.
And I'm sure if it was wrong, if the lip readers had got it wrong, you'd know. But they just nailed it every single time. And so, in a way, we gave these guys voices after 100 years with modern actors. But it's the only place in the movie where we sort of,
Well, it feels sort of very much cheated. Like you we made cheated. Them more real, yeah. But it's not a device for no reason. It's
no.
a device for a very
no.
important it's, reason.
Yeah, I just,
it's kind of remarkable. You know. They found you are one of the few people in the world, I think, who has the resources. They didn't know what they wanted. You didn't know what you would do, but you have the resources to make this kind of
and
thing.
And a lifelong interest in the First World War as well.
That too. You know, I didn't even know
so
that
this
you did.
I'm not a historian by any stretch, but I know this topic very, very, very well.
So it came together kind of brilliantly. I understand that you are now wanting to apply this technique to your earlier films.
Well, people have been talking to me about when I'm going to re-release, you know, my old films. And I've got the rights to most of them. No, they're for Bad Taste and Meet the Feebles, Brain Dead, Heavenly Creatures, those four.
What are they called? They're called your... They have a name.
The horror ones or...
Yeah, the horror.
Splatstick.
Splatstick? Okay.
Yeah, like a splatter and slapstick.
And you were really going for it in these films, right?
Yeah, but I was shooting them in 16 mil. And
I mean, I read that when you were shooting... What was the first one? Was it the puppet
taste.
One?
Bad taste.
You were actually
was the
keeping
one.
The print under your bed? You were
no,
like
no, it's worse than that. I was keeping the negative under my bed.
The negative under your
I
bed,
shot,
I'm sorry.
I shot it over 4 years. You know, I was working in a newspaper and every weekend
I'd
shoot
something. You were like a photo engraver.
Yeah. And then when we finally got the film finished, what you do then is you've got to go and get the negative and you've got to cut the negative to match. And so I pulled this negative out from under my bed and it was moldy. It had got splotches and stains all over it. And actually in the movie you see some of the, I mean, no one will probably notice, but you can see there's mold stains on it. Anyway, I've never done that. I didn't keep the Lord of the Rings neg under my bed, I can assure you.
Not, no.
It's, but so people have been saying to me, and we put, you know, these films came out in the 1980s and early 90s. So everyone said, well, you're going to re-release it on Blu-ray? And I said, yeah, yeah, yeah. But to be honest, I haven't had the time because I want to do a nice job. But also, I've been, you know, 16 mil. I did actually a test about 5 years ago on 6 years ago on a bit of Bad Taste and it looked pretty crappy even just then. But now we've got this World War One has enabled us. We've written all the software and codes for restoring it. And I did a test just recently on some Bad Taste footage and it looked fantastic. So I've decided now, you know, now I'm going to try and do it in the next 12 months. It's, you know, it'll take a while because I want to supervise it very closely and I'm going to apply my World War One restoration techniques to my old 16 mil films. The time has come.
So are you thinking of doing this for other archives? I mean, people must be approaching you for all kinds
just
of stuff.
Just beginning. But to answer your question, you know, I would love archives all around the world to sit up and pay attention to this and start restoring it. It doesn't have to be us doing the work. Because it's
like
just digital.
It does,
it's digital. It doesn't cost a huge amount of money. I mean, once you figure it out, it's a pipeline. But there's so much historical footage, you know, that if you imagine all the stuff from the 1910s and 20s and 30s that is so important, historical film, and we look at it and it's shaky and people just aren't really interested. But you could make this, again, you could bring the humanity back into these films. I am we're talking to someone, which is actually a really exciting project that looks like it's going to happen, is that there's a civil rights museum and they've approached us about giving us civil rights film. And doing this. So that's a project that we're hopefully going to be doing in the new year.
Okay, final question, I swear. Last time we met,
yes.
you were shooting The Hobbit. You had almost quit The Hobbit, but then you couldn't quit The Hobbit.
Right, no.
So where are we with vis-a-vis the Amazon project? Are you going to do it?
Well, I can't do it in the sense of, you know, they require like a showrunner writing lots of scripts and things. And I spoke to them a year or so ago and, you know, we're right in the middle of doing Mortal Engines in this film. And you just realize you can't. I mean, I don't have a lifestyle that lets me, unfortunately, you know, work on writing 10 scripts or...
Right.
But, so I said to them, look, you know, I'd love to help you in any way I can, but you're just going to have to go and get scripts written and, you know, and then let's have a look and see what I can do to help. And I haven't heard that they've got their scripts done yet, but I'm very happy to look at them and see if there's any way that I can do something to help them. I mean, it's also part of me that would just love to sit down and watch a Tolkien thing without having been involved in it because I get to enjoy it.
Maybe.
But at the same
not.
Time, but I don't want to be, you know, they are very nice people and I want to, if there's anything I can possibly do to help them, I'm very open to it. But I think they're busy off with their heads buried with showrunners and scriptwriters just working on it now. So
I'm sure
we'll see what happens, your
blessing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I could talk to you about a lot of things, Peter Jackson, but the time has come.
Next time I'm in the States.
Next time you're in the States, I'll hold you to it. Peter Jackson is the director of many films. His newest one is They Shall Not Grow Old. Thank you for joining us.
It's been great, Kim. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.